Okay, welcome to Discovery Lecture 2. Okay, who's looked at the new Discovery Curriculum? Has anybody looked at Discovery Curriculum 1? Has anyone looked at Discovery Curriculum 1? Yeah, just a second, guys.
Excellent.
Let's open my chat window. Okay, now I've got a chat window open. Now, has everybody had a look at the chapters we are going through in Discovery 1? Like, have you all seen the email that tells you which chapters we're going over so that we can bridge you all into Discovery 2? Has everybody seen that email that went out on Cavi Announce? Okay, but have you started looking at the chapters inside the curriculum yet? Have you actually, for example, looked at Chapter 3? For example, or Chapter 4, the ones that we're going to be going over. Has anybody actually looked at the material yet? Because I'm not going through all of the material this time round. I'm going to rely on people to read their notes. I'm not actually going to, because I've actually got to bridge you through these modules of Discovery pretty quickly so that we can get on to doing Discovery 2. But we're not... we're not actually going to go through each chapter like we do in ITE, so it is very important that people read the notes. Unfortunately, there is no translated, accessible Arabic curriculum because we don't have diagram descriptions in Arabic. Okay, the other thing that is very important... that we've all got to keep in mind is that Discovery 1 has diagram descriptions in it. Discovery 2 does not have those diagram descriptions yet. Therefore, you have to look at the diagrams descriptions separately as you did with ITE 1. And the labs are still being modified. We are not going to be using Packet Tracer at all. We cannot use Packet Tracer. It is inaccessible. Therefore, we will be modifying those Packet Tracer labs. So understand that Discovery is a work in progress and that not everything will be ready to undertake straight away. But there is good news. In Discovery 1, all of the quizzes are in accessible format inside the chapters. Okay. Now, before I get started, does anybody have any questions? And yes, you are in the right place, Glenn. What about it? What's your question? You'll need to have it set up in about 2 or 3 weeks. And there are notes on the QCAT website that explain to how to have it set up. If you do not have TerraTerm set up, you will not be able to access the remote bundle, which is a... the remote bundle is a remote lab that has a number of computers, routers and switches that you will be performing your labs on. Okay, and I'm just going to... I'm going to post a message to the list after lecture that will explain exactly the location of the TerraTerm install notes. You need to install TerraTerm, and you need to compile and install a JAWS script. Otherwise, TerraTerm will not talk. Alrighty. So we'll post the location of that, and people can work on getting TerraTerm up and running over the next few weeks. The other thing that I have to notify people is that the virtual machines, DVDs, will be posted out in the next few days, and they will be airmailed. So you should receive them fairly quickly. However... you do not need virtual machines until ITE 2 Module 6. Has anybody already installed VMware Server and have it running? Has anybody set it up without the DVDs as yet?
I've got 32 blades with ESX on them, if that counts.
Right, back again.
No, Mr. Howell, that doesn't count. You may have 32 blades with ESX on them, but you're not undertaking ITE2. Are you? Did you enrol in ITE2? I was trying to remember whether you were doing it or not.
No, I'm just here for comedic relief.
Ah, like how many QUT employees does it take to change a light bulb?
None. We've redefined darkness as a university standard.
Exactly.
It's like how many Microsoft engineers does it take to change a light bulb?
No idea.
None. They just redefined the industry standard to dark.
It's like how many IBM technicians does it take to change a light bulb?
No idea.
I'm not sure, but if I look up document number GC4186B, the interchange of electronic incandescent devices, I'll be able to tell you.
So hard, is it?
Yeah, something like that. Okay. We're going to start... Because you haven't been transferred in yet.
Are you looking forward to the tram ride, Elise?
Hi, Aaron, I was going to bring it up. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've told Gary I'm in, and that is going to be fantastic. Have you ever been to Melbourne?
Sorry, I missed the last bit of that. The chat thing went off my ear.
Sure. Have you ever been to Melbourne?
Yeah, plenty of times. I used to live in Tokemoor.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I was thinking about that tram this morning, actually. It's a 1927 tram I hear on the radio, so it's not one of these long, super long things, so I don't know how we're going to all fit in it, but they've been doing it for years, so I'm looking forward to a good night.
Yeah, the food looks sensational. I had a look at the menu yesterday.
Wonder if it tastes sensational,
though. I haven't got that far. Well, I don't know. I haven't got that far yet. I just looked at Gary's email that said where it departs from and how much it cost.
Okay, to answer your question, Ibram, you don't need to do module exams until you have been transferred into the Discovery 2, and you cannot do the module exams for Discovery 2 until we have done the bridging modules for Discovery 1, which is what we're doing today. I will talk to Ian about how and when you will be transferred across. Until you are transferred across, access the curriculum from the QCAT website.
Ibrahim, no, you can do start your ITE2 exams anytime you like now.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Are the ITE2s up on the Cisco site for us to get into?
What they're asking about is the exams. Have the students even been moved into the ITE2 class yet? Do we even have an ITE2 class on the NETACAD homepage yet?
I will double check that for you and get back to you shortly.
Thank you, and I just sent my first batch of worksheets through to you.
I was just about to send you an email saying you are a quick little girl.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I thought I was slow. I sat down to them the other night and I thought, hang on, I've got to read a few class notes here before I finish these. I sort of had them in.
They were my first.
They were the first. Oh, wow. Oh, they're all done. I finished them this morning.
Good one.
It's probably worth pointing out that just because you are not in the class yet, you are still able to start on the ITE2 worksheets, and in fact it would be in your best interests to get the ITE2 worksheets done, and along with some of the CCNA worksheets that you can do. So just because you have not shifted across into the class, do send Geraldine your ITE2 worksheets as you complete them. As you complete them. Not all in a big batch in 6 weeks' time.
Otherwise, I'll be going.
I only sent three.
No, that's fine.
I had three half-completed worksheets for a few days, which all got completed in one hit.
It's when I get modules 1 to 12 all in one hit that I go, yeah.
I prefer to do it chapter by chapter just to keep it neat, but there have been
times it's easier
I put
for everyone.
Half of a chapter two. Yeah, there have been times I put half a chapter through, but generally I try and keep it chapter to chapter.
Yeah, and that's very much appreciated.
All right, and if we can't ascertain whether the courses are there or not, we will also ask our fearless leader as to when students are being transferred, and that will happen. And we will attempt to... Actually, when you are transferred, you will receive an email from the Academy that tells you that you have been enrolled in a class. If your email address is wrong on the Academy, fix it now, or like in the next day, because you must have a valid email address in your Academy profile. It's very important. So if your email address has changed, it needs to change on the Academy.
Now there is a class set up for ITE 2. I'll get back to you in a moment. I'm just going to see if you're enrolled or not.
Because I'm not honestly sure how to shift them across, to be honest. It's a bit tricky.
Nor am I.
And somebody who will remain
nameless later to do it.
Yeah, well, somebody who will remain nameless actually managed to transfer somebody I know across and lost all of their previous marks, so it's got to be done properly.
Therefore, it shouldn't be something we expect you to do when you're trying to do a lecture.
Alrighty, let's get started on the lecture proper, now that we've fizzed around for a while. Planning a home network. Anybody give me some of the ideas about the first thing you should think about when you are planning a home network? And note, I use the word planning here. This isn't we've all come home with plastic bags full of stuff from the swap meet and we're just about to hook it all up and see if it goes. Bang.
Can I just interject there for a second?
Mm-hmm.
I just did, didn't I? No, you're not enrolled yet, anyone, but I will get in touch with our fearless leader and get him to do that pronto.
Thank you, Geraldine, because when they come up, I'll do the exams.
We know a lot of you have been asking about this for a while. Peter Cliff's enrolled, apparently. That's good. Yeah, so, right, we want all those exams done by Saturday, Peter. Off you go. Okay. So we know you guys have been asking about that, and we haven't forgotten, but we will check with our fearless leader and see when you guys can get shifted across. Make sure that if you are to be shifted across, and I know a lot of you have, you must do course feedback or we cannot graduate you. Okay, what's the first thing we have to think about when we're planning a home network? The very first thing.
Well, I'm going to throw cost into the mix.
I'm thinking even before you even start with that, what's the very first thing you should think of when you go, oh, I'd love a network? What's the very first thing you might want to think about? Everybody overlooks this one.
Why do you need it?
Why do you need
exactly.
it?
What are you going to use it for? Are you going to copy... Word documents that are across it, or are you going to transfer DVD images? And in fact, one of the planning decisions in our network, which is why we have gigabit, is because it does actually take a while to copy 4 gigabytes of DVD image up onto the file server at 100 megabit. I'm not quite nasty enough to make anybody work out how long that would be, but if this was CCNA1, you would be expected to tell me how long it's going to take to transfer 4 gigabytes of data at 100 megabits per second. Now, if anybody gets bored, they can come up with the answer to that in the next 5 or 10 minutes. All right, so we've decided what are we going to use the network for, and that is going to influence the sort of network we're going to put in. And in fact, what is one of the biggest initial decisions that we need to make about the network as far as its infrastructure is concerned?
Topology?
Yeah, that's one of them. Yeah, location of the machines is the one that Glenn's putting in. But what's an even more fundamental thing we'd like to decide before we really get hooked in and going? Think simple, people. Really simple.
Well, what router you want?
Thank you, Louise. Will it be wireless or wired?
Hmm.
So as you can see, this planning stage is important because you have to figure out what you're going to do in the big picture of things, whether it's going to be cabled or wireless, whether it is going to be whether you're going to have 10 megabits, 100 megabits, or gigabit. All right. Now, what else do we have to concern ourselves with? Alright, so the cost is probably a pretty good one. How much are you going to spend? Okay, so Glenn said the location of machines. What, is one in the Bahamas, or what do we mean about location of machines? Well, how would that impact? Does your microphone work, Glenn, or not? He doesn't have a microphone on his, so, yep.
Okay, well...
Yeah, what rooms are you going to put it in is what Glenn's saying,
When I first did it, I considered the rooms we were putting it in. I started off with both the machines in the same room, but then we graduated the machines in different rooms, so how do we want to get the cabling through? We cabled the house. This is when I was living in the last place I was living at. And it just sort of all grew from there. Oh, we want a machine in the dining room. Well, we'll put a point in for that, and that was before we went wireless, so yeah.
Oh, why was Graham on? Oh, well. Okay, so the cabling, that's important. And probably one of the other things that you'll find is that you've got to make sure that the cabling is safe and that people aren't going to trip over the cables. And if you have, and it's not true with everybody, but a lot of females, for example, are very sensitive to those horrible blue cables that you're going to run everywhere. So you've got to figure out where you're going to run that horrible blue cable, TM, as to where, whether or not you're going to trip over it or not, or whether the other half or the better half is going to be upset with your choice of cabling.
Or if it's at Kerry's old place, it's just about at head height.
Yeah, that was the only place we could run them, was over the top of the door frame. Is Graham logged on or what? Are you on, Mr. Pierce, or not? How come you're so far away from your microphone? I can hardly hear you.
I suppose a lot of that depends on whether you own your property or rent it.
Is that better?
That's a lot better. What brings you to Discovery 1/2?
Louise told me to come here.
Oh, righto. Okay, I'll blame Louise then. That's all right.
Should I be here? Should I be excommunicated?
Well, you don't have to be excommunicated, Graham. It depends if you want to sit in on Discovery 1 for a little bit of revision. Aaron's lurking as well. Might be something different to do.
Yeah, I'll sit around.
This is Graham, everybody. He was one of last year's students, and he will be eventually going into Discovery 3 and 4 once we get them running. We also call him Mr. Wikipedia due to his penchant for looking things up on Wikipedia reasonably quickly. He's also a Wikipedia editor and spends far too much time editing articles, in my not-so-humbled opinion. So that's Graham.
And I'll be the first to admit.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've talked about whether it's going to be wireless, whether it's going to be wired, where the cable's going to run, what rooms are the computers going to go in. What's another consideration we might want to consider when we're thinking about the rooms that the computers go in? Any other situations that we might want to worry about? Is there reasons why we might not put computers in a certain room, for example? Or are you happy to have your laptop in the bathroom?
Oh, well, now that you mention it. Yeah, well, this is just it. It's whether the room's moist, it's whether it gets too much sunlight, and things are going to get hot. It's whether it's even too close to a window and you might be fearful of being broken into or people seeing it from outside. There's lots of things to consider.
There certainly is, and they're the things before you even go out and buy the equipment, okay? So these are things you should have even thought of, which nobody does, okay? But this is the stuff you're supposed to think about. Now, it's all right if you're setting up your home network, because if you mess it up, you can often, go and buy a few more bits or take it back to Good Deal for You and get, another one. But if you are actually doing networks at a business, you can imagine that if you muck it up for a business, you might be in a little bit more trouble. There we go, just organising what's going on in the next hour or two. Okay. Now, what sort of things would you need to plan if you're putting a network in for a business? Can we think of things that might be relevant to a business if we're putting in networks and things?
Let's talk client-server, just because it's cool. The positioning of your server, keep it away from the front office, stick it in the back, a nice place in the back office, or in a room. Cabling through the premises that you've got, because you definitely do not want your visitors coming in and tripping over your blue Cat 5 cable. What else? Oh, probably heaps of things.
That's right. And a lot of these are covered in the Discovery notes for Discovery 1, Chapter 4. Look, I realise it's a lot of reading, guys, but I would really suggest that you at least take a read-through of the Discovery 1 curriculum, because it is really well laid out, and I realise I'm going out on a limb here, but I think you actually might enjoy reading this curriculum, because it is actually well written, and it goes through all of the home sort of 2-bit networks and things that most people are dealing with themselves, and one of the labs, for example... Well, it's not actually a lab, but the idea is that you should know how to connect your Xbox to the internet, stuff like that. Gemma will need to know how to connect her hairdryer to the internet, stuff like that. So it is really focused at sort of home and small business networking. And I know you're all going to kill me, but I don't think you actually have to use binary in this one. So we may just all do the hard one first semester. However, binary is definitely worth knowing, and you have a flying start over those normal Discovery 1 people, because you will know how to subnet. We all know how to subnet, don't we? What is the subnet mask on a network with 64 IPs usable? 62 IPs usable in a 64 IP address subnet. I've just got the right answer from Gemma. Can anybody else tell me what the right answer is? Subnet mask of a network with 64 usable hosts per subnet?
What /26 is the CIDR, thingy?
Yeah, very good, Graham. /26 is the CIDR notation. I'll give you that. But what's the subnet mask for /26?
Yeah, 255.255.255. Can't think today.
Looks like we all don't know how to subnet as well as I thought yous did.
That's where I went to downhill and went south for me at about that time.
Oh, so this is you guys had to. Did you guys have to subnet in the CCNA1 final? I haven't actually looked at the final exam.
No, I haven't done the final.
I think you do.
It's 192, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, Graham. How'd you come up with that answer?
It's a binary number 11000000.
That's exactly right. In other words, 128 plus 64 is 192. Boom, boom. Two elephants fell off a cliff. No, but that's the answer.
Just as an aside, another really easy way to do it is to subtract the total number of hosts from 256.
You took the words right out of my mouth. It must
you
have been while
words
you were subnetting.
Out of my mouth.
Okay, so what's the subnet mask of a network with 32 usable hosts per subnet?
That's still /26.
With 32 usable, 30 usable hosts even, sorry. I'll change the question. 30 usable hosts. Technically, you are 100% correct, Mr. Howell. With 32 usable hosts, you would need a /26 subnet. What if we had 30 usable hosts? Yeah, this raises an interesting point, people. CCNA1 is assumed knowledge. Does everybody...
Well, that's going to be a question I've got.
Okay, what's your question?
Well, if you're going to be transferred over to Discovery, which sounds like a really cool course to do, and I've only done a fraction of CCNA, actually I was going to sit down and do the Module 5 exam the other day, how does that work? Do we get transferred over at an appropriate point through the Discovery, or do we, as you say, assume knowledge in certain or all areas, or what exactly happens if you get what I'm getting at?
You get transferred over once... All right, check with our fearless leader. I would transfer you over when you had finished CCNA1, because I'm personally of the opinion that you could use that network subnetty knowledge and stuff that you'll gain in CCNA1 to great advantage in your work. But that's just my personal opinion. You should probably check with Ian. He may cut you straight across to Discovery, but... we will excuse you for not answering the subnetting questions if you haven't got to them yet. It is the meaty bit of CCNA, so to speak.
Yeah, thanks for that, because that was going to be one weekend when I sit down and go, right, I'm going to sit down and do subnetting. So it was on the agenda, but I've had a pretty chronic year when it comes to other things. And fortunately, the school bit's been the highlight of my year, actually.
Oh, well, we can change that. No, just kidding. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, look, what I'm really going to have to suggest to people, and this CCNA1, and I realise a lot of you sit down and work this out off lecture, and I'm asking you fairly quickly, by the time you get to Discovery 3, you're going to want to be able to do that like that. So be warned, you want to be able to subnet in your head.
That's of particular importance for anybody who's actually planning to sit either of the CCNA certifications when they actually finish these courses, because if you can't submit in your head really quickly, you will not pass.
That's right, Mr. Veteran. And Mrs. Veteran, I should say. Geraldine hasn't actually sat the certification, but she's done CCNA 1 through 4.
And wow. Now he's calling me a veteran.
You now get the pleasure of dealing with Pearson View.
Sorry, Mr. Darren?
What I was saying is you now get the pleasure of dealing with Pearson View.
They are like that, aren't they?
I got you that time. Thanks.
Okay. Now, the answer for the 32-address subnet with 30 usable hosts was 255.255.255.224. Thank you, Gemma. Okay. All right, I'm not going to ask any more subnet questions. I'm just going to terrify you all by saying that's assumed knowledge. And we're going to come back and do it in a week or so and see how you all go. Now, if people honestly have trouble subnetting or you're having trouble subnetting quickly, we need to know that and see if we can help you to become a bit quicker on the actual subnetting, because it should be something that you should be able to do with practice in a few seconds. Okay, so we're planning our home network. And the other thing that Chris has mentioned that we might want to look at is downtime. You know, how long is he going to be asleep after he's come back from the pub? No, I mean the downtime of the network. What are you going to do about downtime? Is your sister going to kill you if the net goes down for 2 hours a night, for example, if you have a sister? You know, how is downtime going to affect your family? Do your parents need to do internet banking? Or moody housemates, yes. What is going to happen if you have the network offline for a week and a half? Are you going to have very grumpy people on your hands?
Yeah, I had gone to the effort of setting up Nagios, and then I found out that NASA's much faster.
For those who don't know what Nagios is, it's a network management system that actually tells you what things are up and what things are down. And Nessa, that's an Aaron's fiance, and she looks at the lights on the hub and goes, "The one connected to the Mac's gone out, Aaron." Okay, so we're considering downtime. And do you think downtime is important for a business network?
Yeah, just a little.
How would you feel if all of your servers fell over a less and you're on the phone to a potential client? Would that make you happy and calm?
I've had it happen, and it doesn't make you happy and calm, which is why we've changed a lot of people over to a better one, but yes.
Okay. What about downtime and power reliability in your own personal installation, he says, asking a question that should have an answer that I'm aware of.
I'm buying ups.
Yeah, exactly. And can anybody other than Elise and Aaron, who definitely knows what they are, and Elise, who definitely knows what they are, and Gemma, who definitely knows what they are, tell me what an UPS is?
An uninterruptible power supply.
Ah, and I bet you there's an article for that on Wikipedia. But yes, that's correct. Okay. Uninterruptible power supply. And what do they do? Can anybody tell me what an uninterruptible power supply does?
They beep at you.
They do? Why?
Because they want to tell you that the power's gone off and that you'd better get your computer shut down if it's not directly connected to the UPS and, do it reasonably fast. Save your work and shut down, and then ring up the power company and abuse them.
That's assuming that all of your phones aren't cordless phones and you have just lost power to all of them as well, which will often stop you from ringing up the power company until you find the mobile.
Oh, you ferret around in the back of the wardrobe looking for the T200.
Exactly. Okay, these are all things that are worth considering. And in fact, there are a lot of companies that run a voice over IP, PABX, for example. We have one here at the association. And if the power goes out, I can't actually walk down and ask Trevor what would happen, but I think you'd find that the entire switchboard will go offline.
So you need a very big UPS.
Yes, and I don't know whether they've got any UPSs on the switchboard here, or not, I dare not ask. But let's assume they do.
Actually, at work, we have we supply power to all our phones through PoE and then just protect the switches.
Okay, now, do you want to tell anybody what PoE means? Because I'm sure that not a lot of us, I do. And what's PoE?
Oh, sorry, yes, power over Ethernet. There's actually an extension to the Ethernet standard, which I believe is 802.3AB or something like that, which allows power to be sent as well as signals. So if you've got low power devices like web phones, you can power them off your switch, and then you only have to worry about protecting power to the switch instead of power to every single phone in the building.
Yes, and you can also run power to a telephone without having to have the telephone near a wall outlet, which is a very important consideration when you are planning your network. Where are the power points? And in fact, the first thing that Gemma and I do when we move into a new house is we figure out where all the power points are, and then we figure out how many extension leads and power boards we're going to connect to them all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as Chris just pointed out, if all that happens, he then puts in an application for the rental application. But yes, it is a very important consideration.
Or you start saying to the people, if you're going to rent a property, may I put more power points and phone points in like I once did?
Absolutely. And you say, I'll pay for them, and they can stay when I move out, and that tends to make them happier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get happy about that, yeah.
Okay, power over Ethernet. I actually believe that it uses the... I thought it used the unused pairs in the 10100 standard to supply the power to the device, because I don't think it works on gigabit Ethernet.
Yep, it does. I've got a power over Ethernet gigabit phone sitting about a metre away.
Ah, okay, so they've obviously found a way to shuffle it over the gigabit ports as well.
Yeah, that's only relatively new. Everything up until these particular, we're using Alcatels, but Cisco have them too. Everything else was 10100, but now they're starting to roll out gigabit ones.
The other time you also want to be using things like power over Ethernet is if you're putting up wireless network and you're trying to bridge between buildings, you may want to provide power to your wireless network access point, and you probably don't want an extension lead running out the window onto the roof. Well, generally you don't.
Now, some of the little book-sized PCs that people are selling now, like ASUS and others, can also be PoE, so you literally only have to run one cable to them if they're running headless.
Yeah, absolutely. And headless, for those who don't know, is a computer running without a monitor.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's an interesting term.
Most of Kerry's house.
Looks like it's using power over the unused 4/3 and 7/8 wires.
That's one of the standards, but they must have a multiplexing standard, as Aaron pointed out, because to do that on gigabit, you have to run it over a couple of the used pairs.
Hmm.
I'd be looking up power over Ethernet on Wikipedia, in all seriousness. It might actually tell us what the new standard is.
I actually just looked it up off Google. Just go back a page.
Okay, the other things you've got to look at when you're looking at planning a network is the number and type of hosts that you're going to connect. A host being defined as what?
A machine, a computer.
Yes, a computer, a workstation. And you can also have clients and servers. And you might have a server on your home network, or if you've on our home network, you've got four servers that are usually on our home network. Four, is that right? Yeah, that's about right.
Wow, your electricity bill must be good.
It is actually quite good, at least, because two of the servers only draw between 2.5 and 5 watts of power. They're called a FIT PC, and they're about the size of a CD-ROM drive, a bit smaller, in fact.
Oh, that sounds good.
And they've got 60 gig disks and dual 100 megabit Ethernets, two USBs, and audio, and a little power input for the 5 volt power supply. So they're very low power draw.
What's one of those worth?
$285 US, I think, plus the shipping. So it works out at being about $350 Australian.
Do we buy them overseas, or are they available here somewhere?
The FIT PC you can actually order internationally from www.fit-pc.com. They have a 60 gig 2.5-inch hard drive. They have 256 mega RAM. They have dual Ethernet, as I said, audio, two USBs, power input, and a serial console. And you can actually make the BIOS accessible over the serial port. And they're an AMD Geode LX800 at 500 megahertz, and they run Linux very well.
You could stick your mail server on something like that.
I've got one acting as a router, which is working as our traffic shaping and traffic control router. It's got two Ethernet interfaces, one connected into the ADSL modem and one connected into the local area network. I get to talk about my network in this course. It's great.
I was going to ask about that, two Ethernet adapters, yeah.
And we also have a toaster, which has a crumpet setting on it, which has absolutely nothing to do with the course, but we have a toaster, and you put the crumpets in, you press the crumpet button.
You can plug it in, though.
Yes, you can, yeah.
If only to a PowerPoint.
That's right. So it's power over power, basically. Okay, so... Yeah, power over copper, that's right. Okay, so... yeah, one of them is the server that is our router, and it's got Shorewall and Ubuntu and some traffic control scripts with the hierarchical token bucket schedule-y stuff, which is all very exciting and advanced. And I have fun with it on a Saturday afternoon. I really do need a life. The other server is our MP3 box, which is connected into our stereo system. And it has some MPD installed on it and a whole lot of different web front ends that my wife has downloaded and jiggered into working. So you can cruise through our MP3 collection and play it on the stereo.
Got to talk to you about that at some point.
And that remains publicly accessible until I figure it out and log in and start Peter and the Wolf playing at 11 o'clock at night because Kerry was ignoring me.
Yes, indeed. I did actually end up changing the permissions on my sound devices after that. I also made sure I didn't give Aaron another account on my system. No, I did actually, but it's actually been deleted in the recreate, so you'll need to get it back at some point if you need it. But yes, he did put Peter and the Wolf on at 11 o'clock at night, and I had the amplifier on, and it came belting out of the speakers and woke me up. Alrighty. Okay, the other thing you're going to have to consider is what sort of applications are going to be running on this network, like, you know, applications that use the network. And as a lot of people have found out, for example, one of the accounting packages we use over in Australia, Mind Your Own Business, is actually very sensitive to whether or not you're running it on a network, because you're supposed to buy a network license if you're running it on a network, and some people honestly think that they can get away with running it on their home network and that the software won't notice, but it does.
Yeah, quick patch to Samba fixes that.
Yeah, you just... sure it does, and I won't talk to you about that in lecture, but I'd be interested to find out about that out of lecture as to what interim measure is required while you're getting ready to go out and buy the network license, of course. Okay, what about security and privacy considerations? And what sort of networks are these especially important for?
Wireless ones.
They are. And can anybody other than Aaron tell me why?
Because you can get tapped into and somebody could drive up your driveway and get your internet. And if you've got Windows machines on there, probably get on them and look at your files.
If you have very bad security settings, they certainly can. Which is why we go through all of that tedium stuff in ITE about having good passwords and good security and having passwords on accounts.
You don't share ADC drives and stuff.
Actually, I came up across a nasty thing with that the other day. We had the misfortune of installing, what's that thing called? One of the antiviruses. Avast. And I went and turned off all of our Seedroller shares without asking us.
That was bloody clever.
Yeah, you sort of got this free thing that's sort of like restrictively licensed to you for a certain amount of time and doesn't do half the stuff you want it to, and then it goes through and makes all these arbitrary decisions on... I mean, perhaps turning off the Seedroller shares is a good thing to do from security, but it would be nice if it actually told you that that's what it was about to do. And this brings up an interesting point, and we won't mention any names, but we actually had a student last year who was pestering us for about a month or two about why he couldn't share files across his local area network. And it turned out that his vendor had pre-installed a third-party firewall on his computer without his knowledge.
Oh, yes, that was a fun one to track down.
And you probably assumed he'd checked all that before you started to troubleshoot it.
Well, we're not going to go into it too much, but let's just say that the very first message we sent to him was, you should definitely check if you've got any third-party firewalls. And about the last message we sent to him basically said, well, see, you should have checked whether you had any third-party firewalls. Okay, you're supposed to document the logical and physical topology of your network. In other words, how things are laid out and how things are actually connected and how the packets and things are going to travel. Otherwise, you can wire yourself into network salad and you won't know how anything's connected. And case in point, I have actually gone back and documented what is plugged into all my switches now, because I've got so many of them. Actually, that's not true. There are two switches that still aren't in the documentation, but that's this weekend or next weekend's project. Okay. And, especially if you're working for business, the reason you are documenting the network before you install it is so that you can actually have documentation to show the managers, and also make sure you are accountable for your design and things, and then if you leave the company, somebody else can pick up where you left off. Now, it says talk about integrated devices. Everybody should have seen in integrated devices those router, wireless, ADSL, modem combo things.
Mm-hmm.
Like the D-Link GSL, DSL 640, G604T, which is one of the things that Chris is running, and he's in love with D-Link. And we're not. We don't. But he does have a Linksys WAG 54G, and we've got a whole lot of WRT 54GSs, but that's neither here nor there. these devices usually have a router, some of them have an ADSL modem, some of them have a wireless access point, and a switch all built into the one box. Can anybody tell me why people might like that?
Because it's easy to set up, relatively.
Yes, it's easier to set up, unless Graham's hooking it up. Actually, that's not true. You managed to get your billion hooked up, didn't you, Graham, eventually?
In about 5 minutes flat, actually.
Ah, excellent. Okay, but what's one of the disadvantages of an all-in-one device?
If one bit breaks, you lose a lot.
That's right. If Gemma trips over it in the dark, that's the end of it. Single point of failure.
Meeting, guys. Back later.
No worries.
See you, Aaron.
See you.
Okay, the other thing you probably want to do is document the baseline performance. How do you expect your network to behave? And what sort of speeds and things do you expect? And the reason you're documenting that is because when it all goes pear-shaped, you'd like to have some baseline to know what it was supposed to be like when it was working. Otherwise, you may never know that it's gone funky. Another interesting case in point, one of the first things I did once we installed our gigabit infrastructure was test the comparison between it and the 100 megabit infrastructure to ensure that we're actually getting our money's worth out of the gigabit. Okay. Simple file sharing. Can anybody tell me what simple file sharing is? I've just had somebody rearrange the words and said file sharing for simple people. It's not quite the answer I was after. Oh, Gemma's just used a big word. She's used a big word. She said it does not use granular security. Wow, that's really clever. What's granular, Gemma? Simple file sharing is where... A big word, that's right. It's a bit like granola. Now, it's a bit like... Simple file sharing is where you either say that the files are shared or not, and they're either shared read-only, or they're shared read-write. And can any... all of the files in a share are shared. Now, can anybody other than Gemma and Chris tell me what is wrong with files for simple file sharing that are shared read-write?
Anyone can read and write them with no way to change permissions. Like, if I go on the network, you won't want me writing too many files, so you'll want to change the permissions for me.
Okay, the question was, what is the problem with simple file sharing? Enables just asked me to repeat the question. If files are shared, read-write. That's exactly right. Anybody can modify your files if they have connection to your network. And this is especially true if you have wireless networks with no wireless security. Any bloke on the street, literally, can jump onto your wireless network. Any girl on the street can jump onto your wireless network. Not that I usually see Gemma storming around jumping onto people's wireless networks.
What about my lawyer sister?
Oh, yeah, her lawyer sister... associated with an access point that was in a flat above her, and then had the hide to complain when they turned it off. They're like, they turned off the internet.
How dare they?
Story in IT1.
And I sort of said to her, you are aware you're stealing, aren't you? Oh, no, yes you are. Just because you're jumping on somebody else's access point. Yeah, that's their internet you're stealing. I said, but their signal's on my property. I said, no, but you've actually made a conscious decision to connect to that SSID.
That's right, you don't automatically get connected to it.
Oh, no, that's right, it actually does ask you, because that Windows actually screams blue murder and says that you are connecting to an unsecured wireless network. Are you sure you want to do this? Funnily enough, she's stopped using that network now once we pointed out that little legal problem. Not that she may have necessarily got caught, but in Australia, you pay for volume. And if you're only on, say, a 300 meg plan, it's possible that somebody else can use your 300 megs up before you even get online. Okay, can anybody tell me where you find simple file sharing? What operating system is this thing prevalent on?
Windows XP Home.
Windows XP.
Windows XP Home is the answer I wanted. You can turn Windows file simple file sharing on and off. In Windows XP Professional and Windows Media Center Edition, you can actually turn it on and off. And however, you cannot turn it off under Windows XP Home. Windows 9X did have, well, actually, it wasn't actually called simple file sharing. It was actually called user level access and share level access. which was a different paradigm. Yeah. Okay, so that's that stuff from that module. Has anybody got any questions? No questions? Oh, okay, well. That's all right, I suppose. Are we down a few people today?
I was wondering that.
How are you today, Eddie? Or are you sort of snoozing there on the side?
I'm good, Curry, thanks.
Oh, okay, you are awake there. That's all right, then. You can snore, too. I mean, with Ventrilo, we'd never know.
I'm still here.
And Eddie's been doing a very good job on his labs. I've been marking them recently, and he's been doing very well. So anybody else who hasn't done their labs, they can get them to me as soon as possible, especially the subnetting ones. I'm actually pointing that at a local student here. Mr. Nameless. Mr. Legless, even. Yeah, Mr. Nameless. Okay, the IP. Can anybody tell me what IP stands for as far as computer networking and the internet is concerned?
Internet protocol.
Internet protocol, yes. And would everybody agree that the IP is a very important part of TCP IP? The TCP IP protocol suite? Yes, it's pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
That's the IP part. Yeah, that's right. And if you don't have the IP part, not a lot happens. You can't address everything at the network layer. I don't know whether Gemma's trying to get extra points and stuff here today. she's been studying for Ethernet too. She's on fire here. There's, you know, we're just keeping nice and warm around, you know, the fire of Gemma's intelligence here. Yeah, you cannot address things on layer 3. In fact, I should just give her the headphones and she can do the lecture. No, she has to go in a minute, so we can't do that. We'll do that next week. Okay. All right, so the IP network layer, it's all good, okay, and we've got IP addresses, and we talked about that last semester. This should be like deja vu all over again. That's what Garfield says anyway, okay? Okay, allocation of IP addresses. Can anybody tell me how IP addresses are allocated in the big scheme of things? Like, how do people get IP addresses or organizations get IP addresses?
Well, either dynamically or statically.
No, that's not quite... Not quite the answer I'm after, fellas. I'm after the big global way of things. How does, like, Key West Internet get IP addresses or whatever? Okay, so...
Internet people or whatever they're called?
RARs, I think they're called, and they're actually regional allocators. And you've got, like, the Asia-Pacific, like APNIC, and you've got InterNIC, and you've got various organisations that are responsible for handing out IP addresses in blocks to places like ISPs. And how do ISPs... what do ISPs do once they've been given a block of IP addresses? And they don't go to the pub and get very drunk.
They statically or dynamically allocate those to their users.
That's right, statically or dynamically. Now, I know that was what you were all thinking I was asking, so let's get on to that bit now. What is a static allocation? Okay, so Gemma has just said it's where the administrator runs around the office and goes and configures all the workstations. I would actually say more specifically that it's the work experience boy that runs around the office with the administrator chasing them with a big stick. Okay. It was a small business. Okay. So, in other words, your IP address is allocated statically, which is done in the control panel and the network properties or whatever of your operating system, or it's done in the boot scripts of Linux, or it's done in that stupid system preferences thing on the Mac. Can anybody tell me a problem with static IP address allocation?
You just got to watch that you don't have two machines on the same network with the same IP, or you'll get a big complaint from your operating system.
That's right. You've got to make sure you do not have two IP addresses on the same IP address. What about typing errors? I just thought to myself, I had this song, you know, I can't type, I can't ping, I think I've gone and broken just about everything.
Well, if you type it in wrong, it's not going to go, is it?
Yeah, so there you go. So if you make typing errors in your IP address allocation... Hey, you know the other big problem with static IPs is when... And you get this on help desk. You get people to go into the network control panel, which is always a bad start, and then they just make stuff up.
Yes. Let's just make up an IP address, yeah.
Yeah, so okay, so I've got like 10.9.4.7 and like 255.255.255.0. And they just feed the subnet masking. It's always 255.255.255.0. In fact, I don't even know why you should be able to change it. I mean, it just should always just be 255.255.255.0. Now, the idea here is that you, as networking students, are not... You're having too much fun, aren't you? Gemma doesn't want to go. She wants... Birthday. Yeah. All right, well, have fun seeing Helen.
It's my lottery numbers. Back to front.
Okay, so imagine you've just got this IP address, and it's like, and you just feed in 255.255.255.0. Now, you as networking students, you should know what that means. And not that you've just typed in, like, a few twos and a few fives and a zero. Okay? So, you need to statically assign all of that. What is the other way of assigning IP addresses? If you're not doing them statically.
Dynamically.
The all-new dynamic IP address, an IP address you don't have to worry about. That's right, just turn your computer on. It will send a DHCP broadcast with a discover request. The DHCP... Yes, we had a friend who came over and connected his machine into our network, and I said, you just click it, and it's grabbed an IP address, and it worked. And he sort of sat there for 5 minutes going, but I didn't do anything. I just plugged it in, and off it went. I can't believe this. I didn't put anything in.
You can have an IP address for just two easy payments.
That's right, but don't send any money.
Any money will bill you. And have you noticed they're always easy payments?
They are easy payments. I don't know how they decide whether they're easy or not, but they obviously must know.
They are easy, because if they were hard, you wouldn't do it.
That's right. Okay, so you get assigned an IP address automatically by a DHCP server, which actually stands for Dynamic Host Control Protocol, I believe. Everybody thinks
it's CCNA1 and
ITE1,
so it must be right.
Everybody thinks it's configuration protocol, but it's not. In fact, people just get like TLAs and FLAs, and they just make stuff up. TLAs being three-letter acronyms and FLAs being four-letter acronyms. So, you know, okay, so you get handed out. Who is responsible for configuring the DHCP server?
Your highly paid, successful system or network administrator.
And where do you get a highly paid and successful system administrator from? Why don't you consider employing a CAVI graduate? That's right. QCAT will provide...
The Cisco Academy.
Exactly, like whoever that is in Enable, like any of the people in Enable eventually. Once you all get through and finish this in A1 and 2, you'll be these highly skilled network admins, and you'll be helping people very much. Okay, but you are responsible for configuring the DHCP server. What happens if you get it wrong?
You get the sack.
Users complain.
They do, very much so. And it's something to be aware of. We should mention here very briefly good old APIPA, Automatic IP Address Allocation, which is that thing that Windows does if you can't obtain an IP address from a DHCP server. Alrighty, now the other thing that is worth mentioning, apart from the fact that Kerry is yawning, is that... what was worth mentioning? I've forgotten now. Oh, yes. Integrated devices like home routers and wireless access point router things usually have an integrated DHCP server. And by default, the DHCP server hands out IP addresses to local clients, both wired and wireless.
It does. And Kerry's going to get me to put my Linux one on one day and turn the DHCP off on my router, I think.
Well, it is certainly a learning experience. We can at least try that, but we'll see how we go. But yeah, I think the Linux ones. Poor dog sneezing. Okay. Now the other thing we need to keep in mind is, however, and this is one shortcoming of the router's DHCP server, is that when you turn the router off, it forgets about any of the IP addresses it has previously assigned. That's right. The router forgets all of the IP addresses that it has assigned. And when you if you turn your computers on in a different order, Sometimes it does, but there are rules as to when it can do that. And in fact, if your PC already had a lease and actually asks the router to renew that lease, if nobody else has that IP address already, you will get the same IP, but there is no guarantee. Exactly. So, something to be aware of. What happens, however, if you are using a server to allocate your IP addresses, such as a Linux box, or a Windows 2003 server, or something like that?
Well, I guess you could remember it can remember what machines have been assigned what IP addresses, I guess.
Yes, and the file. It can, and that is called a persistent lease database, just so that you can sound really intelligent. Even if you're not, you just say persistent lease database and people go, wow.
So which means if you're sitting there on DHCP, you could actually always give that that machine a particular IP address.
Well, there are two ways of looking at DHCP. You can actually put in static reservations, which means that you say, for this MAC address, I always want to hand out this IP address. That's called a static reservation. However, the other thing to keep in mind with a DHCP server is if you have a pool of addresses, and a pool of addresses is where it takes its available addresses from, and that pool of addresses is big enough to hold all of your machines, okay, so you've got 64 IP addresses and 40 machines, and you have a persistent lease database, all machines will retain the same IP address unless you change their network card, because it will remember the MAC to IP mapping automatically.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is one caveat to this. If you have a pool of addresses that is not big enough to handle all of the machines, and you turn off some of the machines and turn on other machines, the DHCP server will reuse the IP addresses that are available in the pool, if they are not currently leased by an active machine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's something to be aware of. And you can set up DHCP servers under all different sorts of operating systems. Although, funnily enough, I went looking the other day for a free one for Windows that wasn't internet connection sharing, and I couldn't find one. So isn't that interesting? I could find free ones for Linux and all different free ones for Linux. I think the Mac's got one, if you find out how to start it up. I know OS X Server definitely has, but I think you can even get the client to do it if you're careful. Yeah, you can through Terminal. I mean, all the good stuff in Mac happens in the Terminal. But I couldn't find one that was free for Windows, so that was interesting. Although, that said, if you are using internet connection sharing, which I have been known to use on the odd occasion when I've been in a bit of a bind, it actually turns your machine into a DHCP server, but that DHCP server does not remember its leases. Alrighty. Now we're going to talk about NOCs and POPs. Can anybody tell me what a NOC is? An N-O-C. No, that is a NIC. I want a NOC. N-O-C.
I don't know.
No, Graham, not an ordinary computer. A Network Operations Centre. And I was just about to go, knock, knock, who's there? It is your ISP that's calling. Yeah, there we go. So, a network operations center is where all of the equipment for the ISP is stored, such as their mail servers and file servers and web servers and stuff. And that has to be fairly reliable, otherwise the customers leave. Interestingly enough, I worked for a small internet service provider in Lismore in New South Wales. And one of the biggest problems with working for Lismore Internet, the only internet service provider at the time in Lismore, was that people would accost the admin at the supermarket while he was trying to buy his groceries, going, excuse me, Todd, my internet doesn't work. And this was somewhat of a problem. The even bigger problem was when his ex-webmaster advertised 24-hour tech support on the homepage and put in his home number.
Oh, boy.
Yes, and he did get calls at 3 o'clock in the morning from some of his clients going, IRC isn't working. And he wasn't very happy about that, and he had his home number changed as a result.
It's amazing how far we've come in the last 13 years and stuff, you know, since ISPs and stuff became really, really popular.
Exactly, exactly. And I remember getting on the internet in 1993 through the Australian Public Access Network Association, and that was a hobbyist group that was trying to get the internet into homes. And this was before sort of things like Microplex and stuff became quite popular in 1996 and Aussie Mail and those sorts of things. Okay, so you want your ISP to be fairly reliable, and that has to have power backup and all those sorts of things in their network operations centre. Now, apparently there's a lab in Chapter 4 where Amelia is walking around the NOC doing a survey of the equipment that is available in the network operations centre. And the lab wants to know what sort of equipment is in the network administration centre. I want to know whether Amelia is available for lunch, but I would suggest that you do the lab and suggest some of the different equipment that might be available in the network operations centre as part of the Chapter 4. Because as we go through these different sections, we would like to see the labs that you can do from out of the Discovery 1 curriculum. Okay. Ping and trace route. All a bit of revision from last lesson, last semester even. It don't mean a thing if you don't get that ping. Can anybody tell me what ping does, apart from makes a cool noise? No, it doesn't make any noise at all. Although, it does if you hit the enter key really hard, yes, but it also makes a noise if you use ping-a under Linux, which beeps when a packet is returned.
Internet groper.
Well, yes, that's one of the tests, whether a computer is connected or not. A ping sends an echo request packet to a computer, and the computer, if it doesn't have a firewall up or it's turned on and all that sort of thing, will send an echo reply. A little bit like sonar and ping. Okay, can anybody tell me what trace route is?
Trace is the route or route to a destination website or host?
Yeah, it shows you the route from one the packets go through from source to destination. I just closed my chat window. 1 second. Yes, that is correct. If a host is unreachable, you will get a request timed out. And that is a very good point. And in fact, there are some labs where you actually do pinging. And once we get the remote bundle fixed, which will be real soon. At some point, we can then, you know, you can do ping labs and stuff. Although I think you guys had to do a ping lab as part of a lab in CCNA1. I actually saw that lab from Chris, actually. That one, I got that one, yeah. And in fact, it asked you to ping a site that was unpingable, which was quite interesting. Alrighty, and traceroute shows you which way packets go. Why would you want to do that? Because the internet is a complex beast. Packets can go all different ways to get from source to destination. If we send a packet from here to India, there's no guarantee that it's always going to go the same way. So what you can also do is you can run traceroute. I didn't have my mic open when I said that. And you can then see which way the packets go. So that's a very important tool. Can anybody tell me what the traceroute tool is called under Windows?
Trace RT, I think.
Remember? It is. No, that's because Microsoft people don't want to type, but they took some of the letters out of it. Okay, so at what you have at ISPs is you have DSL AMs, which are... can't remember what the AM stands for.
Something multiplexer, isn't it? Active multiplexer?
Yeah, it could be, or ADSL multiplexer, or it's in your notes, so we can look that up. But you get DLSMs and you get CTS, which is cable termination systems. And they're the big, funky things. Oh, you're back from your meeting, are you?
Yep.
And you still have a job?
For now.
Ah, excellent. I was just kidding, actually. I was sure that you would, but you always got to check after somebody goes to a meeting.
Yeah, it's dicey, but it's still there.
Ah, jolly good. And do you know what AM stands for in DSL AM? I'm trying to remember. It was in my notes that I read last night.
Access Multiplexer.
Yeah, it is Access Multiplexer. Yeah, DSL. Digital Subscriber Line Access Multiplexer. There we go. Lucky he came back from his meeting. Okay. You can also have ISPs that have banks of modems. And that's pretty, you know, pretty retro. I remember at Lismore Internet, we had 64 indial lines, four lots of 16s, court 1 through court 4, ironically enough, and they were Cisco 2511s, and we had 16 modems connected to each Cisco. So, and we had 64 lines and 64 phone numbers. And would you believe that if you've got 64 phone numbers, Telstra charges you $20 a month times, this is Australia, 64. So you better get some customers or you're going to go broke pretty soon.
Now that's interesting that they did it that way, because at flat rate we had a pair of E1s and we had 30 modems hanging off each of those across three 5260s. So we actually had ISDN incoming and they were split up into 60 channels per modem.
How come you've got, have you got wind or something
hard to
on
listen
you?
To, isn't it?
Sorry about that.
Very rumbly and quiet.
Should be all good now.
Yeah, you're really good now.
Yes, what he said was is he had 60 modems across three E1s, or E1 or something. That's essentially what he said. But when was that? That was sort of late 90s, though. This, we're talking about 1996 here.
Oh, okay, yeah, they set up in 98. So, for those who've done the, I think it's in CCNA 2 or something, no, it's not till 4, anyway, so, yeah, they were ISDN PRIs.
Yeah, now, we had a DDS link, a 2 meg DDS, digital data service link, that came into the Cisco 2509, and then we had the phone lines done as analog phone lines with analog total control boxes from US Robotics is how we did it.
So when you dial the main number for the ISP, does it select a modem for you to connect to, or how does that work?
Yeah, you have a rotary. It goes right round, baby, right round like a rotary. And you dial one number and it picks one of the lines.
Uh-huh.
Generally, it's actually the only one that's crashed.
Yeah, that's right. The rotary is the one that crashes, and the rest of them are fine. And if, in fact, if you know the number for a specific line, and sometimes you do, because we had people like the Ballina Ice Creamery and the County Council.
You would just give them the direct number.
Yes, you give them the direct number, and you would be able to dial into that particular line. And as a consequence, you would get assigned the same IP every time, or at least you would on our system, because it was dodgy.
Mm-hmm. Now, what if that line had already been assigned by the rotary prior to them dialing in?
Well, what actually usually happens is you remove certain lines from the rotary group once you've allocated them to a particular customer. Although if that customer isn't logged on, you can still jump onto their line. I've been known to do that on the odd occasion because I knew they weren't logged on because their infrastructure was busted or something.
Oh, it was 3 o'clock in the morning and the Ballina Ice Creamery was shut.
Yes, although they did have a 24-hour connection, although I don't think anybody was there. I think the ice cream was just bubbling in its vats. Yes, in fact, ice cream with hot chocolate fudge. Okay, I'm just getting Chris. Okay, and apparently you
buy a donut.
Yes. Donut with the ice cream with the chocolate fudge on top, apparently, is what Chris is interested in. And a cherry on top. Mmm. Okay. Now, so that's all good. And, in fact, what we'll probably do is Louise and Chris can go and Chris can buy, like, a Macca's cone or something and keep him happy, one of those little joy cones that are the hot fudge sundae. Yeah. He dips his fries in his sundae. I reckon that's gross. Now, back to...
NASA does that with nuggets.
Okay, you'd want good equipment at the ISP, and you'd want power reliability. Because you don't want to be downloading that episode of Dawson's Creek and have the ISP's power crash. Not that I condone downloading television shows. That is against the law. Unless... I don't condone watching Dawson's Creek, come to think of it. Although you can legally purchase television shows off iTunes, which is certainly a way of getting hold of television shows legally.
And Channel 10 has a lot of theirs up on their website now that you can actually just go and stream for free.
Ah, do they look any good though, or are they sort
ABC
of...
ABC also do too.
Yes, they have the NASA tick of approval.
Ah, righto. Is that a tick that wanders around your bedroom and goes, meow, and the one on the Mac's gone out?
Yeah, no, it's the world's only meowing tick.
Fair enough. Okay. So, yes, you can watch television over the internet. And in fact, TPG, I think, provides IPTV, not that I've ever tried it. And it uses this thing called IGMP, which is this multicast technology, which is all quite complicated, but apparently is supported by billion routers, and if you want that sort of thing, it works fairly well, but I think you pay a fair bit for it. Okay, I don't know why we got onto that. Oh, because I mentioned Dawson's Creek. Yeah, so you don't want the power to go down in the ISP. That would not be cool. You might be in the middle of updating your status on Facebook, and the power would go out. We do not condone the use of Facebook. In fact, I'll probably be blocking a lot of those things a little later today.
Or you might be editing Wikipedia.
Yeah, I can block Wikipedia, I think, Graham. That'd make for a very productive day for you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, probably.
Yes, but now we'll be setting up OpenDNS, and we can block all sorts of things on OpenDNS.
Why are you wanting to do that?
Because there are laws on what students are allowed to access at the association. And why not let OpenDNS do all the blocking and stuff, and I can just feed the things into the interface rather than having to set up expensive software and complicated proxies to do it.
Plus he's aiming for a job under the new Rudd censorship regime.
Oh, the China one.
Now look, I don't want to do it, but there are, you don't want students looking at pornographic websites in class time.
That's fair enough. But would you really block Facebook?
No, probably not.
He would, but we'll tell them how to get around it with anonymous proxies.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If they can get around it with anonymous proxies, they're smart enough to not be a concern.
They pass CC02.
Yeah, they're past CC02 or whatever, so we're not too concerned about it. It is to stop the casual Facebooker, or not Facebooker necessarily. We might block YouTube, though. There's a bandwidth waster if ever I saw one.
No, absolutely.
Then I'd actually have to download my MP3s.
Well, we don't have a problem with downloading them. It's people that stream them, because with YouTube, people just watch them and they go, oh, look at this, and then they watch it again, and then they watch it again, and then we've run out of our 20 gig a month.
And YouTube wasn't the only place on the internet that had the preview of the opening ceremony yesterday.
Oh, have they had the opening ceremony yet, or was there a mock-up one that they did?
A bunch of Koreans got in with a camera crew and they filmed one of the rehearsals and it got put out on the internet.
Surprise,
Chinese
surprise.
People are not very happy about it.
Yeah, it's called journalistic democracy, apparently. You sort of wonder whether, you know, how many things do have to go out on the internet? I mean, you know, yeah. So it's an interesting question. But you can find just about anything on YouTube from the extremely, you know, happy, fluffy dog bouncing around the yard to something that you wouldn't want to be watching, generally speaking. There's all sorts of things out there. Okay, let's move on. Okay, can anybody tell me what network address translation is, apart from Mr. CCNA Super Duper Aaron, who would know what's what network
NAT.
Address translation?
That's a NAT.
It's a NAT. In fact, it's one of Chris's friends that drinks lots and is a bit crazy. Now we're going the monster gnat.
It was a gnat. It was a monster gnat.
No, what actually
it was
happened?
A CCNA smash.
Absolutely. Now, can anybody, apart from Aaron, tell me what happens with NAT? What is NAT? As far as networking is concerned, not as far as Chris's friend is concerned. Nobody knows what NAT is as far as Chris's friend is concerned.
And NAT's people on the internal network have private IP addresses.
Is that an IP address that you're not showing to anyone else or something? And what's the point of that?
Till now, you can only use, to not waste the public IP address space.
That's
right. And as an internal firewall.
And to allow multiple people to access the internet using one external IP. In fact, I would be very surprised if they didn't have a NAT device at Enable India. I bet you there is one, because I don't think you've all got public IPs. Okay, so NAT is Network Address Translation, and it means that you can have private network addresses inside the network, which are then translated by your networking device, and they are multiplexed, which is one of those funky words for getting lots of things to happen at once, onto one or a group of public IP addresses. And PAT is Port Address Translation, but we don't talk about that. And we're not going to talk about what NAT and PAT get up to on the network. However, because you have the inside of the firewall, which has the private IP addresses, and you have the external side, or the internet side, the NAT router creates a natural firewall. You always say on those boxes, creates natural firewall with NAT. It's real fire, yes. Natural. All natural firewall. And the firewall means that because you are translating network addresses, unless you put in special rules, computers cannot contact machines inside the network unless the machines inside the network have contacted them first. And yes, that is an oversimplification before Aaron jumps up and down. Hey, guess what, guys? That's the end. We have just done all of the revision for modules 3 and 4 and 4 and 5. And we've got lots of stuff to do next week, like 6 and 7, but I'm not starting on that now. Has anybody got any questions? Questions either directly related to the lecture or questions related to anything else. You might have questions. Although we're not answering questions like, do dogs and cats go to heaven? Yes, they do. But we're not answering those sorts of questions. So anybody got any questions?
Deafening silence.
No, we have a question about NAT. Yeah, that's okay. We are awaiting your question with bated breath. I did. It translates private IP addresses into public IP addresses. It allows multiple people inside the network to access resources that are on the internet using one or more public IP addresses. No, I'm not going to tell you how the port translation algorithm works. I'm not going to talk about the different types of network address translators. I'm not going to take about full cone NATs. That's all beyond the scope of this course. Well, you've got six people at home and an ADSL router, and they're all connected to the ADSL router, and they're all using the internet at once. That is an example of network address translation. Your IP address, your ISP only gives you one public IP address, and the rest of your home users share that public address, and the router is the device that shares that IP address for them. I did actually go through how NAT worked in one of the CCNA 1 lectures. I think I went and talked about all the source ports and everything. I seem to have memories of doing that at one point.
Yeah, you did, but I couldn't remember which particular lecture, but I think it was one of the more recent ones.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, so that's how it works. And essentially what it does is it remaps the requests from the machines that are inside the network onto the public IP address, and then it remembers how it remapped them in a special NAT table, and then when the packets come back, it maps them back the other way. It's all pretty cool. And it works pretty well most of the time. Any more questions? Any more general questions or course-related questions? Apart from, have we been moved over into ITU2 and CCNA2 yet, which we'll have to check into.
I have actually sent an email to Ian, so all those students who are wanting to be in ITU2 or have transferred you, or got Ian to transfer you over. For those that haven't finished their labs, sorry, can't transfer you over till you've finished them.
And the same holds true for CCNA, especially CCNA1. If you don't finish your labs, we can't transfer you over. Those of you who are working at your own pace will be transferred over at your own pace, so we know what's going on there.
Sounds good, yep.
All right, so end of the lesson. We'll see you all next week, I think.